One of my favorite characters on The Simpsons is Nelson, Nelson Muntz. I like Nelson because he's complicated and he will surprise you. Nelson's kind of a bully, sure, but he is also someone who has been hurt, someone who's looking for a way to deal with all of the anger and pain and resentment within him. Season 7, episode 20, episode called Bart on the Road. Bart, Milhouse, Martin Prince, and Nelson are on a long road trip. They've procured a car, and Nelson makes them all stop in Branson, Missouri, so he can see his idol perform. Andy Williams. Nelson loves Andy Williams, loves the gentle-voiced crooning, and he stares, transfixed in love through the whole concert. As they leave the concert hall, Nelson says, "I didn't think he was going to sing Moon River," and then bam, second encore. Tears of joy. Okay, anyway, hi, it's Depresh Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. Our guest this week is kind of the Andy Williams of the poetry world. Maggie Smith is a poet. She lives in Ohio, and she became pretty famous for a poem called Good Bones that came out in 2016. It's about the cruelty of the world and the pursuit and preservation of hope. I wanted to get Maggie on this show because I've been thinking a lot about despair and about hope and about cruelty lately. I've been thinking about the cruelty of the world and the fear of living in it. There is so much to be anxious about right now, so much to be depressed about, so much trauma that has happened and is happening and is looming on the horizon. And if you have disorders or just problems related to anxiety or depression or trauma already, whoosh, these are tough times, to put it way too mildly. I was going to lead with that, but I thought maybe Nelson was a little more palatable, bring you in a little bit using cartoons. One way of dealing with tough times, historically, is to turn to the poets for some guidance, for some reflection, maybe wisdom or fellowship. Just as Andy Williams has other great songs, Can't Take My Eyes Off You, Where Do I Begin from the movie Love Story, those are just two of them, Maggie Smith has lots of other well-regarded and popular poems that she can read at whatever the poetry equivalent of Branson, Missouri is. Maggie is the author of 7 books, most of them poetry. One of them, Keep Moving, is described on her website as a collection of quotes and essays on facing life's challenges with creativity, courage, and resilience. Maggie's work has appeared in Best American Poetry, The New York Times, The New Yorker, The Paris Review, lots of other places. When I asked Maggie to read some poems that relate to despair and hope, well, she didn't wait for the second encore.
Maybe I'll start with Free Bird, which is Good Bones.
Your own personal Free Bird.
It's my personal Free Bird.
Your Stairway to Heaven.
It is, yeah. Okay. Or as you said, it's my Indigo Girls Closer to Fine.
Closer to Fine, yes.
Everybody has like that one song that if they don't play it during the set,
right,
they better come back and play it during the encore.
If you're going to see Big Country, they better play in a Big Country.
Correct. Also, if you have a song and it's your band's name, you better be playing it. Like Talk Talk.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? I mean, you set yourself up at that point. So yes, I guess I'll start with Good Bones, where the writing about hope and despair really begins for me. Good Bones. Life is short, though I keep this from my children. Life is short, and I've shortened mine in 1,000 delicious, ill-advised ways. 1,000 deliciously ill-advised ways I'll keep from my children. The world is at least 50% terrible, and that's a conservative estimate, though I keep this from my children. For every bird, there is a stone thrown at a bird. For every loved child, a child broken, bagged, sunk in a lake. Life is short. And the world is at least half terrible, and for every kind stranger, there is one who would break you, though I keep this from my children. I'm trying to sell them the world. Any decent realtor walking you through a real shithole chirps on about good bones. This place could be beautiful, right? You could make this place beautiful.
And that poem, was that 2016 that was published?
It was published in June of 2016.
2016. And I remember that poem making its rounds. And as you say, it became immensely popular. Not to have you do your own publicity, but what was it about that poem that do you think really stuck with people? That, as far as you can tell from all the response you got, what was it that really hooked people?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I would have to like remember what people have written or said about it, because it's always sort of a mystery to me why certain things find a wider audience and other things don't. And often it's like my favorite poems that have the narrowest readership, and other ones seem to find their ways to lots of people. You know, I think with Good Bones, I mean, it went viral, I think, because it was published a week that terrible things happened in multiple places. So the ingredients, the week that that poem were published, it was the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando. It was the murder of MP Joe Cox in England the same week that the poem came out. And so people in the UK and here for different reasons were feeling really unmoored. And then it sort of went viral again, and during the 2016 election. I don't think I have to explain why we were all feeling some despair then. And so from what people say and from what I see when people share it, because the poem's kind of become a disaster barometer for me, like whenever my mentions go up because of this poem, I know something bad has happened or something bad is happening enough that people are sharing this. And it seems to provide some comfort. And I think it's just the last two sentences, because the rest of the poem, frankly, isn't very optimistic. But I think it's those last two sentences about the possibility. I think it's an argument for possibility, like the possibility that things can be better than they are now, and that we have the ability and the responsibility to make it so. I think it's those last two sentences.
I imagine you try hard to think of the emergence of your name online ramping up as a hopeful thing, and not, you don't experience the despair of saying, oh, there's my own name. That means terrible things have happened in the world. Because that could get to you after a while, I would think.
That's what it is. I mean, if my mentions are going really crazy, I go to a news site, because I don't need to weed through Twitter to find out what happened. I just will go to a news site and then I'll see, oh, my mentions are going crazy because there was a bombing here, or there was a shooting here, or there was a, I mean, that is unfortunately/fortunately. I mean, it's a strange thing. You want your work to be read, but not for these reasons necessarily. You know, it's like, well, I guess on one hand, it's if people are sharing it because they're seeking hope, they're going looking for it, as you said, or if people are sharing it because they are sort of like rallying around this idea that things can be better and that we have to take responsibility and make things better. There's something to that. But I have a really ambivalent relationship with that poem for this very reason.
Well, I think the negativity in it really grounds it, though. I mean, there's a lot of places where people can sling hope at you without a lot of substantiation, but the use of the word shithole really sticks with me in that poem, because, you know, I've looked at houses before and I'm like, okay, you're saying this has good bones, you're saying this has potential, and maybe it does, but boy, it's a shithole. And like, yep. I feel like you earn the moment of hope in there that you reach at the end. Like, it comes in a real clear-eyed way.
Well, I appreciate that. It's funny, even to this day, I still will see comments, if I'm dumb enough to look in a thread, that will say like, God, this poem is such a downer, or I can't imagine raising kids with this outlook, or it's like statistically impossible that for every bird there's a rock, because this is how many rocks are probably in the world, and this is how many birds are probably in the world, as if it's not a metaphor and I actually did the math.
There aren't that many bagged children in lakes. We got to dredge those lakes.
I'm like, yeah, okay, I read one news story where that happened. It really upset me, clearly. So I put it in this poem, not knowing how many people would read it. I maybe would have fact-checked a little bit more my math if I had known what was going to happen to it.
Well, I understand that poets actually have licenses, poetic licenses, they're called.
I need to remind people, because yeah. I think they want me to sort of flash that pretty frequently, and I sometimes forget to do that.
Do you have one like laminated, ready to go for those occasions? Because that maybe, would be kind of cool.
Maybe I should.
Yeah.
Like, I think you get might. Get off my back.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe you should sell those like in a merch shop on your website. Well, I'm curious about how you experience hard times. And you've written about your divorce, and you've written about some hard times you've had. And you're a person in the same world as we are, with Supreme Court and COVID and Ukraine and all these things going on. Do you process hard times as, to put it crassly, as material for your poems?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I love that. I've actually been writing about this, the idea that a friend of mine said after my divorce, well, at least this experience wasn't wasted on someone who's not a writer. And I thought,
that's a Hall of Fame unhelpful comment.
Right? I was like, wow, I would prefer, you know, and another way of saying that is like, I don't want this lemonade. Like, I didn't want the lemons and I don't want this lemonade. Like, I've had to make it, you know, like if someone hands me material and it happens to be really painful, yes, I do process as a writer. That's just what I do. I don't know where to put it otherwise, frankly. Like I don't know what to do with it. So I do process it in writing, and sometimes I process it in writing I publish, and sometimes I process it in writing that no one sees. But that's how I know what I'm thinking, is by writing it down. But I'm really uncomfortable with the idea of sort of harm as material that we're supposed to somehow like metabolize and make something good into it. You know, sometimes maybe that's the best we can do, hence the lemonade, but wouldn't it be nice to just not be handed the lemons and to get to write about something else? You know, if I hadn't written Keep Moving in, you know, 2019, 2020, I just would have written another book. It wouldn't have been that I wouldn't have had material. I just wouldn't have had that material, and my life would be better for not having that material.
Right, right. I mean, it occurs to me, as long as you brought up the idea of the turning lemons into lemonade, and this sounds like a sort of cute joke about the analogy, but it's not quite that for me, which is, if someone hands you lemons, the only thing you could really make is lemon juice, which is still bitter and horrible. Because where are you going to get the sugar? You need a lot of sugar. You can't just make lemonade out of lemons unless you have a lot of sugar to begin with.
That's true. So like the other ingredient to all of this is like the sweetness. And that's the stuff that, you know, brings me to tears when I'm sitting on my back patio. Like, I couldn't have written Keep Moving just from despair. And I can't write my poems just from despair. Frankly, I couldn't function if all I felt was despair. We wouldn't be talking right now if that was all there was, because I would be, you know, laying in bed like Cameron in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I think that sort of delicate balance of hope and despair, I need the hope. Like, I call myself a recovering pessimist, which is absolutely true. And I've never needed optimism more than I've needed it in the past 4 years. I need it more. And it's funny, I think a lot about pessimism, which anybody in my family would have told you that until my divorce, I was the most pessimistic person in our family.
More with Maggie Smith on hope, despair, divorce, and optimism coming up. And more poems. Back with Maggie Smith, in conversation momentarily, but first, because we can, an interlude for another poem.
Let me, I'll read one from the new book, Goldenrod. And this was really inspired by the idea that we associate hope with light and thinking about how really morning starts at 12:01 and it's awfully dark and it takes a lot of patience. And maybe tenacity to sort of get through those dark hours before you could kind of see the glimmer of light on the horizon. But that's morning too. The poem's called How Dark the Beginning. All we ever talk of is light. Let there be light. There was light then, good light. But what I consider dawn is darker than all that. So many hours between the day receding and what we recognize as morning, the sun cresting like a wave that won't break over us, as if light were protective, as if no hearts were flayed, no bodies broken on a day like today. In any film, the sunrise tells us everything will be all right. Danger wouldn't dare show up now, dragging its shadow across the screen. We talk so much of light, please, let me speak on behalf of the good dark. Let us talk more of how dark the beginning of a day is.
Before the break and the poem, we were talking about how Maggie, a cheerful person, near as I can tell, was seen as the most pessimistic person in her family until her divorce.
Which kind of makes sense because I'm the poet.
Yeah.
she's a big feeler. She's always expecting the worst. She's kind of a Debbie Downer. And I think, you know, in some ways, pessimism is about control. Because if you expect the worst, you've already sort of like told yourself the story. You flip to the end. Like you've told yourself the story of what's going to happen. Like case closed, this isn't going to work out. Boom, done. I'm in control of what's going to happen. I know it's not going to work. So that puts me in a position of being in control of the situation because I know. And hoping and sort of living in a sort of more optimistic headspace is scary and really vulnerable because you are admitting a lack of control. You're sort of opening your hands and not white knuckling the thing and saying like, well, I'm going to hope. I'm just going to believe that it will be okay, but it might not be, but I'm going to like open myself up and be vulnerable and hope that it's okay and admit that I don't actually know and don't have control over the outcome. And I actually had to have my life sort of completely upended. I had to lose control in order to be able to sort of be, to let go of it.
Well, let's dive into some of that biography then. You talk about always being seen as a pessimistic person. Were you like that as a kid? And have you dealt with depression on a clinical level?
I have not dealt with what I would call depression on a clinical level. Although the only times I've been, I would say, diagnosed or treated for depression and anxiety were postpartum, which again, lack of control out the wazoo. And then I went off of my anti-anxiety medication after my kids got old enough that I was like, okay, I've got this. And then when Good Bones went viral, the introvert in me had like a complete attack, like panic attack.
Really?
About having to talk more, travel more, go places more. And so I went back for a period of time on anti-anxiety meds just because of having to be in the world in a different way during that time, which is really strange to think about that. But mostly I sort of like, I DIY it with therapy and writing and lots of loud music and long walks. Uh-huh. But to answer your first question, yes, I was like a completely anxious, introverted, control freak of a firstborn child who did not like surprises, didn't want to try things new unless I was guaranteed utter success at whatever that new thing was.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, run a race and maybe not win? I'll pass.
Yeah.
Like,
what's the point?
What's the point of that? So I think about it now, and I actually I enjoy life a lot more now, even though things are in some ways a lot more complicated. I feel a lot freer in my 40s than I ever did before.
When were you married and for how long?
I was married from 2005 to technically 2019, and we were together for about 19 years total. So, you know, 22 to 41, about those ages, which is like basically, you know, my whole adult life to the point of, yeah.
Yeah. And then you talk about how you weren't seen as an optimist, or you were seen exclusively as a pessimist until the divorce. Can you get into a little bit of who you were before the divorce and who you were after?
Well, I think I was still kind of trying to, I thought I had things under control, you know, as a parent, as a wife, as a person, like, well, this goes there, this goes here. I think I thought that I had things fairly figured out and compartmentalized, but I see now a lot of that need to sort of like control things and have things just so was a lot about managing my own anxiety about the world. Like if everybody does what they're supposed to be doing, it's supposed to happen like this. The kids get up at this time and then they go to, and then there's a nap and then we have dinner and then they go to bed and then I do this and then we do this. And having a sort of predictable, structured life in some ways was like something I had built for myself, I think, to avoid the rest of it, right? The sort of mess of like, but what else is there? What's going on? And so when my marriage just imploded, I realized, okay, well, that's not an option anymore. Like I actually can't control things anymore because now my kids are not here all the time. And now I'm, for better or for worse, completely responsible for my future.
Yeah.
It's not a group project anymore.
Right. There's no collaboration any longer.
No.
It's so interesting to me because I've interviewed so many people about mental health, and so often disordered behavior and disordered thinking emerges from a belief that there could be ordered thinking, and it could be like, I could get control of everything if I just plan more, if I just stick to more schedules.
Yeah.
And it's almost like it becomes a sense of mythology after a while. It becomes like this fantasy that you're telling yourself. And of course, you know, fantasies don't tend to come true very much.
No, no. I mean, my nickname as a child was Checky Listy. Like I was a list making
fun
maniac.
Kid, huh?
Oh, I was a laugh riot. I mean, it's funny. Like I was a funny kid and I think I was pretty fun to be around, but I also had this other side that was very structured and fearful, because that's where the need for structure comes from. Like it's from, you need structure, you need control, you need predictability because you're scared of what might happen if you don't have all of those things in place. And so I think something about my life being completely upended, well, first of all, it was terrifying. I was not doing well for months and months and months. And then I think I realized, okay, let me reframe this for myself. Like I have to make decisions for myself alone now. I get to make decisions for myself alone now. Like, oh, okay. Like I have to live by myself and do all this stuff. I get to. And thinking a little bit more about getting to versus having to, and like trying to reframe some things as opportunities has actually been super useful to me.
So when you're working on a book, it's, you try to think of it not as I have to finish this book, I got to send this book to my editor. It's, oh, look at this opportunity that I have to create something. How wonderful.
Yes. And with anything, I mean, with anything, like, oh, I have a meeting I have to do today. I have a thing I have to do today. No, I have, like, I built this life for myself in which I get to do this. Like, I get to have this conversation with John today. I get to go walk up and pick up my kids from school because I live two blocks from their school and I built things that way. And so I get to go do that. And, you know, it doesn't always take, not everything is an opportunity. I mean, I think toxic positivity is real and can be a real problem when we try to like pivot on a dime and turn everything into some sunny side. It's not all like that. But more often than not, even the hard stuff has something good tucked inside of it. If I look hard enough, I can find it.
Are you ready for a very unfair question that you can answer however you like?
Oh, sure.
Why did you get divorced?
Oh, that is a big question. You know, I would say maybe 6 months to a year ago, I would have told you either, I don't know yet, like I'm still not clear on exactly what happened, or I would have not told you the reason, but said, I know the reason, but I can't tell you. And now I've been thinking about it and talking about it to my therapist and working through it. And the sort of the best, most succinct answer I can give is I think we are people who did not survive our changes. And I think there are probably plenty of people who meet their spouse in college or earlier or slightly after who then find themselves 20 years later in a very different life space, both just what your life looks like 20 years later, but also who you are as a person is different. And I'm frankly envious of people who seem to grow together. Because I know it's possible. I don't think it's inevitable that if you meet someone young that you will grow in these sort of like a fork in the road. I don't think that's inevitable, but I think it's common. And so that's sort of how I'm summarizing it. That's the story I'm telling myself now.
Okay. That's good.
Okay.
You talked a little bit about with Keep Moving and with some of your work, this sense of connecting it with other people more than maybe you had done with poems in the past. Is your job as a poet to kind of leave yourself open to the world and then make sense of it for readers? Because if so, that seems like a huge job.
That does seem like a big job. Goodness. Yeah, that's not going to go on the laminated poetic license card.
No.
That's a job description I'm not sure I'm actually even qualified for,
yeah,
given my education and background.
Because it's what people rely on you for. I mean, like, honestly, like with Good Bones and with Keep Moving and with some of your work, it's like, what the hell kind of life is this? Maggie, help me out. Yeah.
I know. And I'm like, oh, right. I'm just trying to figure it out, too, on paper. You know, I think the staying open is my job. Like, I think my job is sort of always having my antenna raised and taking it all in. I love the artist Robert Rauschenberg said, I think that the job of an artist is to keep people's eyes open. And I think that's the thing. So it's, I like that definition leaves off the making sense. Which is the tall order.
Yeah.
What I try to do when I'm working on a poem is help myself understand something about the world or about my life. And it's usually very particular and specific to like my way of thinking. And then I sort of like put that little thing like a message in a bottle and shove it off into the water. And I really don't have any idea where it's going to wash up or who might find it or what they might think of it, or if it will help them or make them feel worse or baffle them or do nothing to them whatsoever. And so I don't think it's my job to make sense of the world for other people. I think it's my job to process my human experience in words to the best of my ability and trust. And this is where that sort of openness comes in too. I think trust that it will probably, because this is what it is to be human, it will mean something to someone other than me. Maybe one person, maybe a million people, and you don't know. And the worst thing I think I can do is try to speak for others or even have an expectation about where it's going or what its job is. Like, to sit down to write a poem about the state of the world or about anything. Honestly, to sit down and write a poem about, quote unquote, anything, I think is a huge error. I think sitting down and sort of staying open and whatever metaphor or five-word phrase or scrap of language or little spark that comes to me, and if it can kind of like a snowball rolling down a hill, accrue, in the end of writing that poem, I will be like, oh, that's what I was trying. That's what's happening in my brain. That's what this is about. I almost never know when I begin where I'm going. I don't know where it's going to end. I don't know what it's about. I don't know what the theme is. And most of the time when the poem is done, for plenty of my poems, I couldn't paraphrase it to you or tell you, quote unquote, what it's about.
Wow.
It's like an event in language.
So how does it start then?
It starts with me scribbling something in a notebook, usually.
Phrase or a sentence or something?
Phrase or sentence, yeah. You know, I might be walking and something about the wind is like hitting these leaves, or be like, oh, it sounds like hands rubbing together. Or that's, you know, that bird sounds like a typewriter key, which grackles kind of do when they do this one specific sound. Or my child will say something and I'll write down that little snippet of dialogue and that will get me going on a metaphor. Or I'll be watching a nature documentary with my son and I'll see a kind of bird that has this specific name and it will make me think of the Latin for this other word that makes me think of this other thing. And then I'm off and running, you know, I'm way down a rabbit hole at that point. So it begins in lots of mysterious ways. And the best thing I can do is sort of not let my ego get in the way and try to like tell the poem what it wants to be or do and try to like strong arm it. The best thing I can do is just sort of, as kind of woo woo as it sounds, just kind of stay open to it and trust that it has its own sense and its own mind and almost its own will, and kind of go travel with it rather than trying to steer it too much. In the offset, you know, once I've got a draft and I'm tinkering, then I'm like in the driver's seat. Like, should this line break here or here? Should the title be this or this? But when it's initially sort of like coming through me, I really try to like keep all the valves open and not over censor, not think too much about it, not say, well, that's a dumb idea, I'm not going to write that down. Like, it all gets in and then we decide.
So I think a lot of people want to live that life you're describing where you can notice the wind and you can hear the birds and you can kind of roll those things around in your mind. People want to live a poetic life, even if they don't necessarily want to even write poems. And it seems like you need to have such a wide open heart and you need to be completely unfolded to the world. But how do you do that, especially in this world that we're living in, without getting smushed?
Oh gosh, I think I just get smushed.
Do you?
Yeah, so I don't think I have a great answer for that. I mean,
there's no defense system, just go out there. Wow.
I don't think, and the problem is, you know, it's not always great, right? It's why some days are harder than others. I think I have, you know, some calluses, but probably not enough in the world. Yeah, I mean, just being able to sort of keep yourself open, I think is the most important thing. But I don't know how to advise doing that because I don't know how not to do it.
Yeah. Well, does it get easier if you're just living like that all the time?
I don't know, perhaps. I mean, it's funny. It's sort of like kids. Like, I think all kids are poets. You know, they notice things. They notice everything. And then something happens. And it seems like it starts to happen. It's like, I don't know, fifth grade, sixth grade, like, you know, what, like, whatever that time is where you, and it seems to, you know, neatly correspond to when you start caring what people think of you. You start caring what other people are wearing, what other people are saying, how other people think about your hairstyle. There's something that happens where that weirdness, that sort of like unselfconscious weirdness that we all have, that we are all like, that's our inheritance. We come to this world, we are born, and we are unselfconsciously weird.
Yeah.
Amen. And then something happens and it gets scrubbed out of us over time. And so many of us as grown-ups, she says disdainfully.
There's the pessimism again.
Right. I mean, but we're sort of like, yeah, here's some pessimism. A lot of us as grown-ups are frankly sort of like husks of the people we could have been if we had not let life smush us when we, or not sort of cared so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, you know, thinking about it now, I think that's probably why I'm enjoying my daily life more, say at 45, than I was at 15 or even 25, because I care less.
The weirdness returned.
The weirdness, I mean, frankly, the weirdness really never left me, but I kept a lid on it for a while. But I think you care less. And I remember my mother saying this to me. She's like, oh, just wait till you get to your 50s. Wait till you get to your 60s. The older you get, the less you care about what other people think of you. And that freedom is priceless. And I do believe that. I think kids don't care. And at past a certain age, if we're doing it right, we don't care. But there's a whole swath of our lives in like, our, especially our teens and 20s, where we care so much about other people's perception of us that we lose our own perceptiveness.
Yeah.
In the process.
Is this a good recipe for writing poetry? Like if the listener is hearing this and can find a way to let go of that self-consciousness and free up their weirdness a little bit, will they write better poems? Cliffhanger there. Sorry. Can you write better poems if you allow yourself to get a little more weird or a lot more weird? We'll find out after the break.
You're in a theater, the lights go down. You're about to get swept up by the characters and all their little details and interpersonal dramas. You look at them and think, that person is so obviously in love with their best friend. Wait, am I in love with my best friend? That character's mom is so overbearing. Why doesn't she just stand up to her? Oh God, do I need to stand up to my own mother? If you've ever recognized yourself in a movie, then join me, Jordan Cruciola, for the podcast Feeling Seen. We've talked to author Susan Orlean on realizing her own marriage was falling apart after watching Adaptation, an adaptation of her own work, and comedian Hari Kondabolu on why Harold and Kumar was a depressingly important movie for Southeast Asians. So join me every Thursday for the Feeling Seen podcast here on Maximum Fun.
Video games.
Video games.
Video games. You like them?
Maybe you wish you had more time for them?
Maybe you want to know the best ones to play?
Maybe you want to know what happens to Mario when he dies?
In that case, you should check out Triple Click. It's a podcast about video games.
A podcast about video games? But I don't have time for that.
Sure you do. Once a week, kick back as three video game experts give you everything from critical takes on the hottest new releases,
to scoops, interviews, and explanations about how video games work,
to fascinating and sometimes weird stories about the games we love.
Triple Click is hosted by me, Kirk Hamilton.
Me, Jason Schreier.
And me, Maddie Myers.
You can find Triple Click wherever you get your podcasts and listen at MaximumFun.org.
Bye.
Back with Maggie Smith, we've been talking about eccentricities that one might have cast off through one's life. And I asked Maggie if people might be able to be more creative and write better poems, for instance, if they can recapture that weird.
A weirder is always better. I mean, honestly, the advice I give myself, and sometimes I actually scrawl it like on a draft, is make it weirder. Make it weirder. Stop polishing it dull. Stop making it good but boring. There are plenty of competent poems out there, just like competent short stories or competent novels that are not actually that don't like sort of rewire your brain.
Yeah.
Because they're not weird enough. So yeah, make it weirder, I think, is my general writing advice. Uh-huh. Or just life advice in general.
That's interesting to me as that being a recipe for creativity. And obviously it is. I've always been baffled by poets in the same way that I've been baffled by violinists. Like, I know they're the same species as me. I know I can drag a bow across some strings and sound will come out. But, you know, I've always said, like, if someone held a gun to my head and told me to write a good poem, I would just accept my inevitable death right there on the spot because it's so far beyond my grasp. And it's always struck me that it's one of these things that anybody can technically do, and almost all of us have done it in school, at least at some point. But among people who do it well, there's like you and maybe six other people.
that is not true.
Well,
but also, I have to say that if somebody held a gun to my head and said, write a good poem, right. I would also accept my fate.
Exactly.
No yeah. pressure.
It's like telling a comedian to tell a joke. It just doesn't
exactly.
work.
Yeah, exactly. Do something funny.
Yeah.
Just do something funny. No,
yeah.
I can't do that on command. No, thank you.
But I think it's always been the freedom of it has always intimidated me as a writer because, you know, if I'm writing a song, I'm probably thinking of verse and chorus and some rhymes. If I'm writing stuff for a podcast, I'm hearing a cadence of my voice and I have this duty to inform in a kind of expository way. And like, it seems like poetry is the terror of the empty page writ 1,000 times larger.
Well, I mean, I don't write songs, but I listen to a ton of music and it would terrify me to try to write a song despite how much music I listen to. I mean, I probably listen to 50 songs for every poem I read. So, but I don't write songs. So it's, you know, the idea of having a form or like a known container in which you can work, like, well, I know I'm going to write a song, so I know it has to fit this form. That gives us sort of a guideline, and maybe that's comforting. And a poem is just sort of like, it's a free-for-all, unless you're writing a sonnet or a sestina or something that you know has rules. But it's also, it's sort of like lyrical, like muscle memory. If you run all the time, you get better at it. And your body kind of knows, like, this is what you're doing. Okay, yep, this my leg is going to do this now. If you're running for the first time, it's not good.
You're not going to run a marathon.
Yeah. You're not going to run a marathon the first time. And I think the same thing with poems. Probably the best thing people can do if they want to write poems is read lots and lots of poems and lots of contemporary poems. Because if all you're reading is Poe and Frost, the poems you're going to write are going to sound like Poe and Frost.
Right.
Like, you're going to be a cover band first, always. That's how writing works. And so reading a ton of just really steeping yourself in contemporary poetry and reading it out loud to yourself and spending time inside of it, I think that's probably like the best education. You know, teachers are great, but I think poems are the best teachers of how to write poems.
Yeah. Like in any kind of art, especially.
Yes.
Does writing poetry provide you like a catharsis, a mental therapy, for lack of a better word? Or does it just provide you some poems? Like is there a is there a therapeutic element to what you're doing? And if so, is that one of the reasons why you do it?
I think there is a therapeutic element into the writing itself, but not to the product. So it's not that when I get done with a poem and I read it and I think, oh my gosh, I've done it. That's a good poem. I feel better about myself. That does not happen. I wish that happened. That does not happen. I think the therapeutic aspect is in that I have a place to put all this stuff and it occupies my mind, which sort of runs constantly like a very old, inefficient appliance. You know, I don't sleep well. I'm not like, I need to keep myself very sort of mentally occupied. And so writing allows me, it's like a fidget spinner. Writing allows me to occupy my brain in a way that is also useful. Actually, it's funny. I was out with my mom and my sisters for Mother's Day, and we were talking, and I don't know how this came up, but they were like, how are you the only one in our family who never started smoking and who you drink like almost nothing compared to the rest of the people in our family? Because we have Irish heritage.
Okay.
And I was like, it's interesting. I don't, because I'm also incredibly anxious and always have been. And I said, you know, I think it's because I'm the only one of us who has a creative outlet.
Mm.
It's the only, because I mean, there's no other reason to explain why out of the five people in my nuclear family, I don't have those kinds of like addictive habits, but I do, and it's called writing.
So the poetry is numbing the pain.
Well, I don't know. I just think it's, you know, it's like, I think about people who smoke and it's like, you just want something in your hand. It's like, I remember having a high school teacher who always held his chalk like a cigarette. And I was like, I see you. I know what's going on. I see what's happening there. You really wish that wasn't a piece of chalk. And I think there's something to, at least for me personally, there's something to how if I start to feel myself start to kind of like spiral, that's where I go with it. I'm just like, oh, I'm going to write about this, or I'm going to go take a walk and see what I can kind of like pick up and start to write. And so that's, I have no empirical evidence that that is the deciding factor, but it seems like maybe there's something to that.
Do you try to provide that benefit for the reader in what you write so they could have that same experience that you do?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, that what's the Frost saying, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. So part of what I really try to work into my poems, or part of what I let stay in my poems as much as I can, is my thinking. I like when writers show their thinking in the poem so that what you're getting is not like a packaged, polished product of the thinking, but you're actually seeing some of the train of thought unfold in the poem itself. A lot of my favorite poems do that. And sometimes that means they have digressions or asides, or they might go one way and then they're sort of like a little hairpin turn and they start to go another way because that's the way the brain works. And so I guess my hope is that the sort of thinking, the conversation I'm having with my own mind on the page, when someone else reads that, they won't just be seeing my mind on the page. They'll be like, oh yeah, I think like that too. Or, oh yeah, that sometimes when you think about this, then that leads you to this other association. So I guess I'm hoping that people might see some of their thought process in the poems when they're reading them too.
Do you think that there might be, I mean, would you prescribe the writing of poetry to somebody who's trying to figure out the ways that their mind works? Like, even if they don't intend to have it published in a book somewhere, just as a way of like unlocking their own brain for themselves?
I mean, maybe, but also a personal essay, I think, would get them to the same result. I don't know that poetry has like, you know, sort of cornered the market on knowing oneself. And frankly, like, I think probably I've been able to more clearly articulate for myself what I'm feeling and experiencing when I'm writing prose than when I'm writing poems, because they are so associative. And one of the things I find myself doing, particularly when I write poems, is like really snipping out a lot of connective tissue in the poems. Like, I really want there to be opening for the reader. So I'm not just unloading the whole kit and caboodle. I'm saying, well, this, and then this, and then this. So I'm kind of handing the reader, you know, like a stack of Polaroids that they kind of have to shuffle around. So they have to participate and do some of the work.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, writing in general, I think, is good for getting to know the inner workings of your brain, particularly if you can get to sort of that metaphor space. Like, what metaphors are powerful to you? What kind of analogies would you make for what you're experiencing, or what you like, what does this feel like? What does this sound like? What is this sensory environment? I think accessing that, whether you're doing it, you know, in lines or in prose, is really useful.
we've talked a bit at the beginning about this idea of, you know, the interesting times we live in, the challenging times we live in, the occasions out in the world that can provide a lot of despair and the need to go hunt down the hope. How are you finding hope? What processes are you using, and what results are you getting?
Processes. I like this. I like this idea that it could be so, if only I were so methodical about finding hope and beauty as I am about other parts of my life. I think, you know, I just try to put myself in its way. If I want to find a bunch of information about how terrible things are, I know where to go to find it. It's not hard to find. I know I can access it whenever I want. If I want to worry, if I want to be angry.
A lot of people will help you out with that one.
Right. I mean, there's no, I know where to go. I could go there right now. I know where to go to find it. The question of like, where do you go to find the other stuff? You know, like, where's the sugar? I know where the lemons are. Where's the sugar? And I think it's different. You know, there's some things that I think are sort of universal, but I think it's different for all of us. Where I go outside. That's the sugar for me. I call or spend time with people I love who love me back, despite my quirks, or perhaps sometimes, in, you know, because of them. I'm leaning on my music collection a lot. I may basically just listen to music all the time. This is a break. Like, this discussion is a break, and I will just go right back.
You'll go right back. What are you listening to today?
Well, I've been listening to, my daughter started, she made a playlist for me called Hey Mom. I wrote about it in the Post recently. It's now over 7 hours of music, and it's pretty much all my favorite songs, or songs that we've listened to together, or songs that, like, when they come up, I start laughing because it's kind of a private joke. You know, like, it's like a Rick Roll, but without Rick Astley, you know, like, something, she's thrown something in there as a joke, but it makes me laugh. So it's that sugar too, even if I don't love the song. So I've been just listening to Hey Mom on shuffle. Nice. as much as possible. And it's like, it always makes me smile. It makes my day better. Which is why I think she made it, which also makes my day better. Like, thinking about the fact that it's a gift.
Yeah. Before we go here, you mentioned a few poems that came to mind when I talked about this tug of war between hope and despair. And I've heard a couple of them, but I know there's one more that you have that I'd love to hear.
This one is the last poem in my book, Good Bones. And it's funny, it has a quote from my then 5-year-old daughter in it. And now she, this year she's turning 14. So that a poem is sort of, you know, like a mixtape, a poem is sort of a time capsule of the people we were. And we get to stay kind of like a snow globe, right? Like, we get to stay that age inside of it forever. This one's called Rain New Year's Eve. The rain is a broken piano playing the same note over and over. My 5-year-old said that. Already she knows loving the world means loving the wobbles you can't shim, the creaks you can't oil silent, the jerry-rigged parts MacGyvered with twine and chewing gum. Let me love the cold rains plinking. Let me love the world the way I love my young son, not only when he cups my face in his sticky hands, but when, roughhousing, he accidentally splits my lip. Let me love the world like a mother. Let me be tender when it lets me down. Let me listen to the rain's one note and hear a beginner's song.
That's so lovely.
Oh, thank you.
And good. Not just pretty, but good. Noble. I don't know. I'm trying to find the right adjectives. I'll leave the adjectives to you. You're good at adjectives. Maggie Smith, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. This has been a joy.
You can learn more about Maggie Smith and read a lot more of her poems at maggiesmithpoet.com. She is not the Maggie Smith who played Professor McGonagall in the Harry Potter movies. Completely different Maggie Smith. She gets that a lot, unfortunately. Well, let's dive on into our own minds and our own inner sense of peace, perhaps. Laura House is here. Hi, Laura.
Hello.
What's the difference between getting into a good place of meditation and just being sleepy and falling asleep?
Oh, such a good question. Not much difference.
It's, okay.
I think sometimes we expect like a magical thing from meditation. I think sometimes that can keep us from doing it. Like, I didn't experience some cool thing, so I'm probably doing it wrong. But like, clearly, like, it feels much more like sleep than, you know, like playing racquetball or something. So it really is similar. A meditative state, here's how I learned it. It's similar to that moment when you're about to go to sleep, when you know you're awake, you have some awareness, you hear your partner in the bathroom or, you know, brushing their teeth or whatever, but you're at rest. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's like awake rest.
Okay. All right. Well, let's not doze off here, but let's have you guide us through spending a little time in that space.
Awesome. So super easy to, you know, try it for a little bit is you just want to get comfortable in a comfortable seat, somewhere you can safely close your eyes, i.e. not driving. And just close your eyes. Sit with your back supported and your head up if you can. And with your eyes closed, just notice your breath. You're already breathing, so there's no forcing it or trying to do anything with your breath. You're just noticing it already happening. And you'll continue to have thoughts. That's normal. And so if you can kind of tell in your mind when your attention is on your breath, and then if you can notice how it kind of floats over and notices your thoughts, when you become aware of that when you're meditating, you just notice your breath again. You just sort of keep letting go of your thoughts in an easy way. You can go ahead and open your eyes slowly. This is just a taste of meditation, but if you keep practicing, your mind gets a little more used to it. Like a little, I know in the beginning, sometimes it can feel like, whoa, what's happening? Like it can feel weird to rest.
Yeah, I think it might be, for a lot of people, the only moment of actual 100% silence in the day.
Yeah.
The day is so full of words.
Yeah. I taught a guy who worked at Amoeba Records.
Uh-huh.
And he would do his afternoon meditation. The way we did it was like a two-a-day thing. And like, if you grab this super quiet moment in a really loud location, like it's kind of even sweeter, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah.
it's like extra intense. He's like, I would meditate at a meet. It was incredible because you like drop so far down from, you know, what everybody else right. is doing.
Yeah, it's like landing on Mars or something.
Yeah, like went right to the center.
You can find more of Laura at the Tiny Victories podcast, which she co-hosts with Annabelle Gerwich, or online at laurahouse.com. Laura, thank you.
Thank you.
Next time on Depression Mode, one of the biggest suicide prevention organizations in the country started on MySpace.
Essentially, the story kind of took on a life of its own. I posted it on MySpace. I talk to young people a lot and they giggle at MySpace, or maybe they've never heard of it, but it's like the beginning of the world that they've now grown up in. The t-shirts kind of took on a life of their own as well. Some friends in bands started to wear them, and it all just kind of blew up. And this like Warped Tour, kind of Hot Topic, alternative music, MySpace space, it just all of a sudden was everywhere.
Jamie Twarkowski, founder of To Write Love on Her Arms, is with us. If people support our show through a small donation, we can keep being here together. If not, we can't. If you are already donating, thank you. You are making Depression Mode happen. You're getting poems out into the world, you guys. That's wonderful. Thank you. If you haven't donated yet, it's easy. Find a level that works for you. MaximumFun.org/join. Hit subscribe on Depression Mode. Do that now. Give us 5 stars. Write reviews. That gets more conversations out into the world. Speaking of conversations in the world, my book, The Hilarious World of Depression, is now available. It's sold wherever books are sold, obviously, on account of it's a book. And it's a memoir. There's stuff about my life and my mental health. And there's a lot of jokes in it, a lot of interviews in it. And I think you'll find it really interesting. I want you to know that the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. The Crisis Text Line, also free, always available. Text HOME to 741-741. Please use our electric mail address to get in touch with us, depressionmode@maximumfun.org. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DepreshPod. Our newsletter, the Depression Mode newsletter, is available on Substack. It comes out twice a week. I write it. Search that up. I'm on Twitter at John Moe. Hi, credits listeners. Later in that Simpsons episode, Bart on the Road, the boys end up in Knoxville. They find that the Sun Sphere from the Knoxville World's Fair is now full of wigs, so then they all get wigs. Then Nelson pushes the structure over, crushing their car and their way home. Then the boys all sit disconsolately on the curb in their new wigs, and it's probably my favorite Simpsons episode. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hi there, my name is John Duvall, my friends call me JD, and I'm from Columbus, Ohio. I just want you to know, I'm really thankful for you. I'm glad you're here.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.